Before we begin thinking about Judges, I want you to hear this verse. There is no wisdom, there is no counsel, there is no understanding against the Lord. The horse is prepared for the day of battle, but victory belongs to the Lord. Proverbs 21, verses 30 and 31. There is no wisdom that can outsmart the Lord. If you're familiar with the book of Judges, you realize that the story is told in a very repetitive and disastrous pattern. Israel sins, and most of the time that sin involves some form of idolatry. And because of their sin and separation from God, God then sends an enemy to come and judge them. Sometimes they're carried off. Sometimes they're just oppressed in the land. And things get so bad that most of the time they call out to God. Now, sometimes it just says they call out, maybe just in pain. They're not even calling out specifically to God, but just in pain. But they're asking someone to help, whoever will listen. They serve many gods right now, so sometimes they're confused on which God can deliver. And God, in His infinite mercy, sometimes when He is not even the one addressed, sends a deliverer to defeat their enemies. But we say this is a cycle because it keeps occurring over and over again. And God, in His mercy, keeps delivering them. But sometimes God gives victory in unexpected ways. God's wisdom exceeds all other sources of wisdom, and we've got to learn to trust God's wisdom. This was one of the first temptations, right, that Satan put before Adam and Eve. Are you sure that you could trust God about this issue? I think you know better about how you should deal with this. You know what the fruit looks like. Maybe if you ate, you would have enough wisdom to be able to tell right and wrong. Don't trust in God's wisdom. Go your own way. We're all faced with this temptation. I want to read Judges chapter 6, verses 1 to 6 as we begin. This is the pattern and problem that we've just talked about that occurs often in Judges, but this is one of the most extensive descriptions of the pattern in the book of Judges. The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hands of Midian 7 years. The power of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of Midian, the sons of Israel made for themselves dens, which were in the mountains, and caves and strongholds. For it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites would come up with the Amalekites and the sons of the east and go against them. So they would camp against them and destroy the produce of the land as far as Gaza and leave no substance in Israel, as well as no sheep, ox, or donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, and they would come in like locusts for number. Both they and their camels were innumerable, and they came into the land to devastate it. So Israel was brought very low because of Midian. And the sons of Israel cried to the Lord. Israel does evil in the sight of the Lord, but they're trusting in other gods. And because of this, God allows the Midianites to come and take over. Now, like I said, sometimes the description of the oppression is just in passing, but this is rather descriptive, right? Everything in the land is going wrong. There's hardly any produce left in the land. Even the animals are being taken away. It's hard for the people to survive. And in the midst of the fear and the total control that the Midianites have, there's hardly anyone even living in their homes. They've had to abandon their dwelling places. The Midianites are too powerful. They've come in and taken those as well. And so they're hiding in caves and holes in the ground. It reminds you of what happens in the days of Saul when the Philistines are in such control that the Israelites are hiding in caves and mountains and holes in the ground. The Israelites realize how low they have gotten. And they call out to the Lord. Verse 5 says that the Midianites would come and devastate the land. This construction appears to describe the flood in Genesis 6 and Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. There is not much left. It takes a long time for Israel to get to the point where they remember, oh yeah, maybe we should call on God too, right? And God realizes that in verse 7. He's not quick to answer in this case. Sometimes when they call on Him, He is quick to come and help. But not here. In verse 7, it came about when the sons of Israel cried to the Lord on account of Midian, that the Lord sent a prophet to the sons of Israel, and he said to them, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, it was I who brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of slavery. I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all your oppressors and dispossessed them before you and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God, and you shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live. But you have not obeyed me." And the prophet leaves. That's the end of the story. There's no hope described by the prophet here in verse 10. God says, I have brought people out of oppression before. I've brought people out of slavery before. Why is it taking you so long to come back to me? I've done this for you before. I brought you in this land. I gave you all of this land. But I had one condition. Part of the covenant that we have made is you have to obey me, and you have not done that. You've worshipped these other gods. God has no obligation to help these people. But amazingly enough, he's going to. So after hearing about the problem, after hearing about the judgment, now we meet the hero, God's answer to the problem. This enemy that is crushing and tearing, God's answer is the powerful warrior, Gideon. Now, if you're reading in the book of Judges and you're already familiar, you may think this is the time when Samson comes in, right? Because we really need a mighty warrior right here. Somebody to pull people out of the holes and the caves in the ground. Somebody to really beat back the enemy. Instead, we meet our hero, Gideon. The angel of the Lord, in verse 11, came and sat down under the oak that was in Ophrah, which belongs to Joash, the Abiezrite, as his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress in order to save it from the Midianites. Now you may be looking up there and thinking, wait a minute, I thought you said the solution was Gideon. He sounds like part of the problem, right? He's hiding just like everybody else. God goes to find the answer, the solution to the Midianite problem into one of the holes, into one of the wine presses, where Gideon is trying to beat out some of the wheat so nobody else sees him, right? This sounds like a great warrior. This does not sound like a great warrior, I should say. The angel of the Lord comes to him in verse 12 and says, "God is with you, valiant warrior." Now, if that shocks you, can you imagine how Gideon feels right now? Who else is in here, right? I thought I was alone. And a matter of fact, the angel then leaves. I'm going to come back to this in verse 14, but the angel leaves, and Gideon's calling back, "No, no, come back. I want to talk with you. If God is really with us, why is all of this happening? We've heard all of these things that God has done in the past. Our fathers have told them, but they all seem like ancient history to us. What difference does it make to us? God is not active in my life. How will you deliver Israel through me?" Now I want you now to look at verse 14. Apparently, when the angel of the Lord comes to speak to Gideon, he says, "God is with you, O valiant warrior. That's all you need to know." And he leaves. And Gideon says, "Wait a minute." And the angel turns back around. There's nothing else to say, right? I've already told you all you need to know. God is with you. And he says in verse 14, "Go in this your strength and deliver Israel." We have already established in verse 11 and 12 that Gideon is not a strong person. So what is his source of strength? Is this courage? Probably not, since he's hiding from the enemy. Is it his strength? Probably not, since he's hiding from the enemy. What is the angel talking about? He's not talking about Gideon at all. His source of strength has nothing to do with Gideon. It has to do with what he just said in verse 12. What is that? God is with you. You're out of the equation. You don't matter. God is with you. Well, Gideon misunderstands. And he said, "What are you talking about? I don't have any strength. My family is insignificant in the tribe of Manasseh. I am insignificant. There's no way that I'm going to be able to do that. And the angel again says in verse 16, look at the structure here. I've already said that, right? You can't do it. But the Lord is with you. To answer Gideon's objections in the middle, the angel keeps repeating, the Lord is with you. And in the middle of his objections, he says, go in your strength. That is the strength of God, the fact that God is with you. Every other person described as a valiant warrior in the Old Testament is a military commander. Gideon is not that yet, but he will be because God is with him. He will be because God is with him. Are you ever in a situation when you're going to have to act and you're already so terrified you want to make sure that God is really with you? That's where Gideon is right now. He knows that God has said he's with him, but he wants assurance over and over again throughout this story. Now, sometimes we highlight this excessively. He still has enough courage to go and fight the enemy. Deborah calls Barak a couple of chapters before, and Barak says, I am not going unless you go. Gideon's not like that. He does have more courage than that. He's willing to go if God is really with him, but he's not going until he knows that God is with him. And so he says, look, why don't you stay here in verses 17 to 24? Let me make sure that you're really from God. Let me go get a sacrifice. If you're an angel of God, let me go get a sacrifice and offer it here. He goes and prepares it and brings it back and offers it. And the angel touches his staff to it in verse 21, and he vanishes in it. And Gideon realizes this was the angel of the Lord. And then he's terrified because he's actually seen the presence of the Lord. But God said, don't be afraid. What's the importance of this episode? The Lord's presence is powerful and terrifying. If God is really with you, everything else will work out. The Lord's presence is terrifying and powerful, and no one can fight against him. So now God says, okay, I'm speaking with you, and I'm with you. Let's get to work. What's the problem? The problem is idolatry. Where is the problem? It's in Gideon's own house. Again, Gideon is an unlikely hero. Go take down the altar and the image that your father has made to Baal. Go destroy this. Idolatry has led the people into this situation. If you're going to help them out of this situation, if God is going to be with you, make sure that the people aren't trusting in any idols outside of me. Now again, Gideon is afraid to do this. God told him to go do this and destroy his father's image and idol and altar, but he's afraid to do it by day, so he does it by night so that no one else will see. But he still does it. That night he does everything that God says, and he chops down this image. The name Gideon, by the way, just means little axe. Gideon is living up to his name. He's cutting down the idols that are getting in the way of the people's presence, of the people's absence from the presence of God. But it's fascinating in verse 28, people aren't glad to hear what Gideon has done. They don't want to be delivered from their idolatry. They want to remain in their sin. They want to keep doing what they're doing. They just want the enemy to go away, right? Fix the problem. Fix the enemy. Keep the idols here. So they get upset with Gideon, and all of the people gather together in verse 28 and find out that Gideon is the one who has done this. And so they ask his father that they can kill him the next morning. The one who is going to deliver Israel is rejected by Israel. That sounds fairly familiar, doesn't it? It's what will happen with most of the prophets. It's what will happen with Jesus. They call him out to be killed, but Joash's father stands up for him, and he says, you know what? Probably we should let Baal do that. If Baal's a real god, let him take care of this. If Baal is a real god, let him strike him down and defend his own image. If not, then maybe we ought to be serving a different God. the Midianites hear about what Gideon is doing in trying to assemble some of the troops, and so they cross over in verse 33 and camp in the valley of Jezreel. Now, if you know your geography, you know this is the most fertile part of the land. Any northern tribe is going to survive or fail based on the produce in this area. So if the Midianites come in for another year and take another harvest from the best part of the land, things are not looking good for the tribes in the north. So Gideon blows the trumpet and gathers the people to him. The Spirit of the Lord comes on him in verse 34. I want you to notice in verse 34 and following, though, how everybody comes slowly. He's from the smallest tribe of Manasseh, and a few people from his family say, okay, we'll come with Gideon. Then a few people from another tribe, and a few people from another tribe. See, even the other people don't really think that Gideon's going to be a good hero. There's no way we can fight against the enemy. I'm not sure this is a good undertaking. But a few brave souls are willing to come along with Gideon, and he gets a small army of 32,000. This has not really done very much for Gideon's confidence. Even though we know that God is with us, we like to have the odds stacked in our favor instead of against us, don't we? So Gideon decides that he will reassure himself that the Lord is really with him. He's heard this several times now, but he wants to make sure once again. And so he does this test. In verse 37, he puts a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. And if there's dew on the fleece only and the ground is dry, then he says, I know that you will deliver Israel. Well, he comes out the next morning. He finds the fleece completely wet. He drains it, and it's a bowl full of water. But you know, it would kind of be nice to see that again the other way, wouldn't it? Just to make sure. Things are established by two witnesses. It'd be nice to see that again. So he says, God, why don't we do the same thing? Let's run it over this next morning. But this time, you make the fleece dry and all the ground around it wet. And that's what happened. So Gideon again, even though his courage is faltering, he gathers his troops together. They cross the river in verse 1 of chapter 7, and they're on their way to get ready to go fight Midian. Now, we should stop here and realize that there's a great problem with Gideon's troops compared to the Midianite warriors. Look back in Judges chapter 6 and verse 5. The Midianites would come up with the Amalekites and the sons of the east, with their livestock and their tents. They would come up like locusts. Both they and their camels were innumerable, and they came to the land to devastate it. Now look in chapter 7 and verse 12. Chapter 7 and verse 12. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts. Their camels were without number, as numerous as the sand on the seashore. First of all, that statement should remind you of the promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? Because Israel has not remained faithful to God. Their enemies are multiplying and becoming like the sand of the seashore instead of themselves. But the enemy that is spread before them is innumerable. Even their animals are described as this, in this way. How is Gideon going to be able to fight them? The other problem is he only has 32,000 men. He's had a few times now to come to the grips with the fact that God is really with him. But now he's worried about the obvious problem that they're having mathematically here in what they're getting ready to try and accomplish. And God comes to Gideon and he says, Gideon, we have a numbers problem. And you know Gideon's got to be thinking, I'm so glad you've realized that. Let's take this up a notch, shall we? And yet God says, yes, we've got a numbers problem. We have a ridiculous amount of warriors, don't we? We don't need all of these guys. Gideon's got to be thinking, what are you talking about? And so according to what we read the other night from Deuteronomy chapter 20, he says to the men, all right, whoever's afraid, y'all can go home. It doesn't matter about numbers. It just matters if you trust in God. We just want the people who believe that even though we're outnumbered, that God can deliver us somehow. Everybody else go home. So 2/3 of his army goes home. Can you imagine Gideon having some objections before? He's needing some confirmation before. But here he doesn't get any more confirmation. God says, Gideon, that's still too much. We've got to get rid of more. Take them down to the river. And he chooses out of all of these 10,000, 300 lonely soldiers. And he says, send everybody else back. To which you can probably imagine Gideon's packing up too, right? It's time to go. We can't do anything now. 300 soldiers? I love God's response to this situation. Let's read verses 8 and 9 of Judges chapter 7. 300 men took the people's provisions and their trumpets in their hands. That'll become important in a moment. And Gideon set out with all the other, and Gideon sent all the other men of Israel, each to his tent, but retained the 300 men, and the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. On that same night, it came about that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I've given it into your hands, right? It's time for war. Go down there and fight. Nothing should be holding you back. We've got the numbers now. Go fight. And God says, oh yeah, but if you're still worried about this, if you still need reassurance, take Purah, your servant, and go down into the camp. So Gideon logically takes Purah, his servant, and goes down into the camp. He's still terrified. He still doesn't know if God will be able to accomplish this. They're sneaking into the camp in the middle of a change of watch. And he's coming up to a tent, and Gideon hears in verse 13 someone relating a dream to his friend. And he said, I had this dream. A big loaf of barley bread was rolling down into the camp, and it struck the tent so that it fell. And his friend said, that's none other than Gideon, the son of Joash. Can you imagine Gideon's thought process right now? They know about me and the 300 boys with me, and they're worried about that? This huge army with all of these weapons, they're worried about us? And when Gideon hears that these people are worried about his small group because they know that God is with them, notice what he does in verse 15. Gideon heard the account of the dream and its interpretation, and he bowed to worship. Now, that doesn't seem very significant until you read the next line. What's the next line? Then he left the camp. Whenever you're in the enemy camp, the goal is to get out of the way as quickly as possible without being seen, right? But he's not worried about that anymore. He stops in the middle of the enemy camp and he praises God. He falls down on the ground beside this tent where he has heard that they're worried about what God can accomplish through him. And he praises God and he worships. And then he gets up and he goes back to his camp. And see if these words sound familiar to you in verse 15. He says, arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hands. It's the same thing God told him in verse 9, but now he realizes it to be true. He's convinced of what God is capable of. He's heard it over and over again from the angel. He's seen it and been reassured of it, and now he's heard it in the camp of the enemy. He knows that God can be with him, and now he is no longer distracted. So Gideon, in his wisdom and preparation, begins handing out the implements of death, right? Everybody grab a trumpet, a pitcher, and a torch. What are we missing? It'd be nice to have something to defend ourselves with, wouldn't it? Either defensively or offensively. How's this battle going to go? Shouldn't somebody be bringing the swords, the spears, the attacking weapons? If we're going to be able to defeat them, surely we should do it in a different way. But God's plan is often different than our plan. Now you hear this. If you're preparing for battle, is this good military strategy? No. This is not wise. But God's wisdom is greater than man's wisdom. We learned earlier that the battle is not about the size of Gideon's army. Just take 300 of the boys with you. We learn now that the battle is not won by weapons or military strategy. Just take three random elements with you. But notice what these three elements are and some of the verses that I have down here. With the trumpet is used at Jericho, but its significance centers on something in Numbers chapter 10 and verse 9. Numbers chapter 10 and verse 9. The Lord says through Moses this, "When you go to war in your land against the adversary who attacks you, you shall sound an alarm with a trumpet." Now, what's the purpose of the alarm? Most of the time, it's to sound your own troops that, hey, we're being attacked. But that's not the purpose of this trumpet. "Sound an alarm with the trumpets that you may be remembered before the Lord your God and be saved from your enemies." Alert God that you need His assistance as you blow on the trumpet, and God will come and deliver you. We referenced 2 Chronicles chapter 13, verses 13 to 15 yesterday, when Abijah is talking with Jeroboam, and in the process, Jeroboam ambushes him and surrounds him all around, and he turns to some of his military and his priests, and they blow the trumpet, and they call out to God. They're doing the very thing that Numbers 10 says. We've been outmaneuvered. We don't have better strategy. We don't have better weapons. Help us! And God does so. But also torches. In Genesis 15 and Ezekiel 1 and Daniel 10 and in Exodus chapter 20, this word describes the presence of God. How are they going to be able to win? They're going to ask God for assistance. God's presence is going to be there. Who's bringing the sword? Look in verse 18. Gideon says, "I want you to grab all of these instruments, blow the trumpet, break the pitchers, and hold up your torch when I tell you to, and say, 'For the Lord and for Gideon.'" But when they actually say this in verse 20, they say, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." The Lord is bringing the sword. So Gideon and the 300 men with him in verse 19 went around the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. They had just posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and they smashed the pitchers that were in their hands. When the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, they held the torches in their left hand and the trumpets in their right for blowing and cried, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Each stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran, crying as they fled. When they blew 300 trumpets, the Lord set the sword of one against another, even throughout the whole army. And it talks about the army fleeing south and east of here. Gideon is victorious. No. Gideon had a better military strategy. No. Gideon overwhelmed the enemy. No. The Lord wins the battle. Gideon remembered to call on the Lord with the trumpets. Gideon remembered that the presence of the Lord was the most important part in this battle. Can you imagine, as he's handing out these implements, some wise fellow among the audience may have said, "Hey, we need to do this a different way. There's another wise way to do this," right? Gideon said, "No, we're going to focus on the wisdom that God has given us. Let's make sure we're doing things according to God's way." Gideon trusts the Lord's battle plan. And the Lord wins the battle. God strikes with the sword, using the sword of all of the people involved to fight against themselves. And 120,000 people are killed in chapter 8 and verse 10 in this episode. But here's something we often forget about. Gideon then pursues the other people and has another battle. In chapter 8, verses 10 to 12, he pursues the rest of the soldiers. And there are now 15,000 soldiers left in the Midianite army. Now, for those of you who are good at math, 300 is still slightly less than 15,000, isn't it? All the Midianites need to do is regroup, and they'll be able to defeat Gideon again. But Gideon doesn't need reassurance again. When you have seen the power of God at this level, up close and personal, Gideon has no more questions for what the Lord is capable of. No more questions. He simply acts. He surrounds these 15,000 men who again vastly outnumber him, and he defeats them, and he kills 4 kings in total. Now this is fascinating. Gideon said at the beginning of the story, "Is the God of my fathers alive?" I've heard all of these stories about what God done in the past. Is God alive now? One of the things he probably heard about was when Abraham took 318 men and defeated 4 kings from Mesopotamia who had defeated 5 kings in Canaan, so a huge army, when God had done that for Abraham. And now God has done the same thing for him with almost the same amount of men defeating 4 kings. The God of Gideon's father is alive and well. This story becomes incredibly significant throughout the rest of the Old Testament. Now, I have Hebrews 11 and verse 12 down. I mentioned that for sake of completeness, but I want to focus on the verses in the Old Testament for the moment. This story becomes so important as people think about God's ability to deliver them in present circumstances. So turn to 1 Samuel chapter 12. Samuel's getting ready to die, and the problem is the people have seen that Nahash, the Ammonite, is coming against them in 1 Samuel 12 and verse 12. And if you remember the story in 1 Samuel chapter 11, Nahash has caused a lot of damage in this area and in the land of Gilead in particular, on the other side, on the eastern side of the Jordan. The people have seen what Nahash is capable of, and they've asked for a king. And Samuel reminds them in verse 11 of 1 Samuel chapter 12, these are the deliverers that God has given you in the past. Don't you realize that no matter who the enemy is, that God is able to deliver you? And one of the judges who he mentions in particular is Gideon. Gideon was able, God delivered people in the time of Gideon. God can deliver you even though it seems difficult in the present circumstances. Years after Gideon has lived, his story and example is still being used. Look in Psalm 83. Psalm 83, written by Asaph around the time of David. It's a few hundred years after Gideon. Asaph writes this psalm in the midst of great distress. Many nations, in verses 1 to 8, have conspired against Israel and come against them. You see some of the nations mentioned by name in verse 6 through 8. Many nations have come against Israel, and they are unable to fight against them. Asaph calls on the Lord in verse 1 not to be silent and to rise up against their enemies. And he uses as an example in verses 9 through 12 what God has done before in the case of Midian and in the case of Deborah and Barak in verse 9. And then he reiterates it in verse 11 that God defeated these 4 kings of the Midianites in the days of Gideon. He asked the Lord to deal with the present enemies in the way that he's destroyed previously the Midianites. You see, the Lord's victory over the Midianites still speaks, right? It still means that God is capable of destroying his enemies in the present. It's not some old story about what happened to our fathers years ago. It's a God who is alive, who can presently help us, who has helped us in these circumstances. And we ought to live in light of this victory that Gideon has been given by the Lord. Even years after this, Asaph goes back to what God has accomplished. Flash ahead another 300 years to the time of Isaiah. The enemy, the most powerful nation in the world at this time, is Assyria. We discussed this briefly last night. Though it seems impossible at the time that Isaiah says these words, God is going to break even the mighty Assyrians in Isaiah chapter 10, verses 24 to 27. And that story appears in Isaiah 37 and 38, similar to 2 Chronicles chapter 33, which we went over. But notice that he says that God will be able to do this because of what God has done in the past. It's been many, many years since God has delivered Gideon from the Midianites. But he goes back to that story in verse 26 to describe what God is going to do presently in the case of the Assyrians. It's been hundreds of years, but the God of Gideon is still alive. The God of Gideon still delivers. And the God of Gideon cannot be outsmarted or outmaneuvered. He will deliver Israel. But in this context, Isaiah says, let's look ahead for a moment. We're looking right now at the problem that we've had with Assyria. Or Asaph's looking right now at the problem that he's having with being surrounded by the nations. But he said, look ahead. A day is coming in which all who are in darkness will see a great light. That there will be salvation come to this area, that God will raise up a king, a ruler, who will not just be another ruler, but he will be God himself. How do we know that God is going to be able to send a child, a son who's going to be given to us, who the government will rest on his shoulders in Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6. His name's going to be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. And on the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. How can we know that a day is coming in the future when one of the descendants of David will not just be king, but will never be replaced? One of the descendants of David will not just be a Davidic descendant, but he will also be Mighty God. How do we know that a day is coming in which God will send someone who will be true light into a world of darkness and gloom? He appeals in Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 4 to the story of Gideon. God is able to deliver his people from the oppressors. Again, the story of Gideon looks far beyond what Gideon has accomplished to what God always accomplishes in delivering those who are oppressed, even from the greatest oppressor that is Satan. Gideon's story looks ahead to what God will accomplish. So as we think back on Gideon, where is your source of trust? Psalm 20 and verse 7. Some in horses, some in chariots, but we will trust in the Lord our God. What will be our decision? Who will we trust in? But in the midst of the story of salvation, as we think about Isaiah's prophecy, yes, we understand that we can be victorious through the Lord's strength. We understand that the Lord's wisdom is greater than ours. We understand that previous deliverance anticipates ultimate deliverance. But sometimes we have a paradigm for how that should look in our wisdom, right? It ought to look like this if God's going to bring about deliverance. But when Jesus came, it didn't quite look like what everybody thought it should. In their wisdom, they had a picture of the reigning Messiah who would live and reign and conquer and push back their enemies. That's what their wisdom saw, right? But Jesus came to be rejected like Gideon. He came to be rejected by his own family. His own family called out for his death, and he was killed by them. And in his death and burial and then ultimately his resurrection, he accomplished these things that Isaiah was talking about. He brought deliverance from the oppression through his death and burial and resurrection. Human wisdom looks at these things and they say, no, Jesus has died. There's no hope that he was the one we were looking for. You remember the two on the road to Emmaus? They're walking and talking, and Jesus starts walking with them. And Jesus said, "What are we talking about?" And they said, "We're talking about Jesus, the guy who we thought was the Messiah, the guy who we thought would help us, the guy who we thought would be the fulfillment of Isaiah 8 and 9. But now we know it's not true because he died. That's not part of the problem. That's not part of the story. That can't be how it goes." But if you look in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 6 to 13, Satan and all of his forces kill Jesus because they think they're stopping God's plan. They have the same view of wisdom. Surely if God's going to deliver those who we oppress, he's going to have to do it by reigning, not by dying. So they help kill him. But in the process of killing him, God uses their weakness, their limitation, their lack of wisdom against them to glorify his plan and accomplish his purpose and unlock the keys of salvation for us. He brings about freedom from oppression by using the lack of wisdom of Satan and his forces to allow his son to die on the cross, to be buried, and to be raised. God overpowers them with his strength and with his wisdom. In your battles, you have to decide who to trust in. Are we going to fight the way that we've been commanded just a moment ago in Ephesians chapter 6? Or are we going to say, "No, I've got a better way. I think there's a different paradigm that I could follow here." If we trust in Jesus and God's wisdom, that he has sent his Messiah to die on the cross for our sins, that part of our being freed from him is being washed and clothed with him. If we trust in him, human wisdom would say, "Well, we probably need some great, really wonderful thing to show that we're committed to him." But God says, "All I want you to do is believe, repent, confess who I am, and be washed of your sins in baptism." Whose wisdom are we going to follow? Are you willing to submit to God's authority and God's wisdom this evening? Please come as we stand and sing.